So when we, you'll notice the first thing here is the underpinnings of the revolution. And I'm just going to go through, like I said, a broad stroke of what I think were the key events in American history that brought forth the need for independence from Great Britain. First of all, we talk about the revolution. It really started with the French and Indian War of 1754 to 1763. And it was really a fight between the colonists and the British and the native Indians and the French. This was all brought about by territories, who had rights to those territories and who did not. Of course, young George Washington was a colonel at this time fighting for the British and the colonists. And by the way, there's a great movie out. We went and saw it yesterday. Young Washington, I would encourage you to go out and see it. Very good movie. I made the funny remark that after the movie, I said, I wish there was more action. But anyway, 25,000 people died, roughly, is what historians say. 25,000 people died during this 9-year war. This led to a problem for Great Britain and the colonists, if you will, but mostly for Great Britain. They ran short of cash. So what happened as a result of that war really kind of launches into the taxation of the colonists. Here's one, the Stamp Act. This is right after, maybe a year and a half after the war ended, March 22nd, 1765. All paper, legal documents, certificates, wills, playing cards, and dice were all taxed. And it was a random tax. It just depended on what you bought. And so anyway, there's this new tax to help pay for the war that Great Britain started with the French. And of course, young Washington is involved in this. He gets horribly defeated initially, does lead a rebellion, and eventually gets the win, but it comes at a great cost. Then just kind of, I'm gonna just give you two of these. The Townshend Act, that in 1767, taxed glass, lead, paint, tea were all taxed. So now Great Britain, what it's in, there was other taxes in there. So what was happening is Great Britain was trying to recoup money from the colonists to help pay for the war that they just had for 9 years. Of course, the Sons of Liberty then don't like this. And the colonists said, no taxation without representation. And I think this was actually the jump start of why we're able to sit here today in freedom. And all of these events that led up to that moment is why we're able to come to this church on a Sunday morning and worship God as we see fit. So anyway, moving right along. The Boston Massacre, this was a big one. March 5th, this is like three years later after those taxations. The Boston Massacre takes place on March 5th, 1770. British soldiers fired on a mob of colonists in front of the Boston Commons House. Now, that has its own controversy as well. Somebody in that crowd yelled, fire. Historians say one of the soldiers yelled it. Most historians believe that the colonists themselves yelled it. And shots rang out. As a result of those shots, five colonists were killed. I'm going to try to spin some of this into our culture today as we go along, but these five colonists die. John Adams now, in 1770, he is the one that defends these British soldiers and does such a great job with it that from November 27th to December 5th, 1770, these soldiers are acquitted. Now, there were some charges that came along with it, but you can understand how Britain now is looking in the eyes of the colonists. They are taxing us. They are taxing us crazily. And now they've fired on our own citizens. This is one of the famous drawings of the day from the literal newspaper, maybe not colored, but and it shows this Boston massacre that took place. And the Redcoats, or John, they're not really called soldiers, they were called regulars. And Paul Revere's Midnight Ride, he did not go through saying the British are coming. He came through saying that the regulars are coming. So anyway, this is one of the times when media plays an important part of rallying the colonists. Look at this. This was an actual newspaper. Here's four coffins. And if you're looking at this as a colonist and you're seeing the British fire on citizens and killing them, that would create an anger. We think about one moment in our history, there's actually several, but one of the big ones was everybody in this room that was alive and at least able to understand, do you remember 9/11? 9/11, we'll never forget those planes hitting the towers in New York and how much anger there was directed at those who did it. I think what happened here in this case, and I picked this deliberately, in the colonists, it created a sense of anger. Now, there's something else to notice here. Right here on this right side, a runaway slave, they want him back. America's not perfect, and slavery was not dealt with until 100 years later when Abraham Lincoln dealt with the issue of slavery. Of course, that led to a civil war between the North and the South. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers died in that war, but at the end of it, slavery was basically abolished. And of course, it took another 100 years with Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement to finally bring it to an end. So we're talking about a 200-year span in which slavery was a central issue in America. But what happened here was really to raise, I think, for the first time that I can think of, you have this national, and this is my interpretation, a national consensus that something needs to be done to deal with Great Britain's aggression. And when you think about it, to try to rule a country from 3,000 miles away is very difficult to do. So this led to a moment in American history that I think is the second pivotal point in this revolution that took place, was the Boston Tea Party. Now, the Boston Tea Party was December 16, 1773. The Sons of Liberty disguised themselves as Native Americans and took over the ship. They dumped 342 crates of tea into the Boston Harbor. Now, the question is, okay, that doesn't seem, that really doesn't seem like a lot. Well, it was 92,000 pounds of tea that was dumped between 7 p.m. and 10 p.m. in the evening. How much did it cost Great Britain? In today's money, $1.5 to $1.7 million. This was a response to taxation without representation. It was also a response, and I want to make a note here. John Adams, can you imagine having to defend these British soldiers, what his life might have been like immediately after those soldiers were cleared? There were charges lesser charges, but they were acquitted on the big charge. So here you have another cost to Great Britain. And of course, dressed as Indians, they go in and they dump this tea over in the harbor. And of course, this enrages Great Britain. They've just lost the equivalency of $1.7 million after they had been taking all these taxes. So all of these issues begin, I think, those are the key issues to the revolution. Now, I kind of want to transition now. So this is, I think, the French Indian War, the taxation, and I only covered two of them. There were many taxations that came up. And the Boston Massacre, I think those were the initial big moments in history. Historians could, I mean, just written books and books about it. But I think those are the key moments that really rallied the colonists and began this march towards independence and separation from Great Britain. So now I want to transition into the Declaration of Independence. So many of us know the author was largely Thomas Jefferson. He was the one that wrote the initial, we could call it draft. They actually have some of the drafts of the writings of Thomas Jefferson during this period. He drafted the Declaration over a 17-day period, June 11th to June 28th, 1776. Now, can you imagine what Thomas Jefferson would think today to know that that Constitution is still in place, largely? That is an amazing moment. And when you look at the history of America from 1776 to today, you can see the providential hand of God involved in it. Pulpits were exploding during this time. I think Holly and I talked about yesterday how much the pulpit was used to rally for the revolution against Great Britain. It really was remarkable. Because here you have a ragtag bunch of farmers, merchants, who have never picked up a gun, and now they're fighting against one of the greatest military powers in the world. So Thomas Jefferson, in a 17-day period, gives a draft of the Declaration of Independence. He wrote this document from a rented quarters at the Graft House in Philadelphia. This is the Graft House in Philadelphia. And over here on the side and on the other side, there's pictures of Thomas Jefferson. And this is really the birthplace of the Declaration of Independence. What we can read today, I would encourage all of us, patriotic, whatever you want to call it, I would encourage us all to read the Declaration of Independence. So this is the actual room where historians say that Thomas Jefferson wrote the first draft of the Declaration of Independence. This was a major step, and it took a lot to get there because of the delegates, and we'll get into that in just a few minutes. But so Thomas Jefferson at this desk, sitting there, drafting the Declaration of Independence that we know today. So after he does the draft, the Second Continental Congress appoints five men on June 11th, 1776, to present a final document. So Jefferson brings the document to the Second Continental Congress. They look at it and they say, okay, we need five men that will do checks and balances and get this finalized so that we can bring it to the Congress. This cannot be understated. This was treason. If this would have failed, all of those delegates who signed the Declaration of Independence would have been hung. This was a major step in American history. So the five were Thomas Jefferson, we know him well, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin. He was quite the character, Benjamin Franklin was. He had a lot of inventions, not just the kite when the storm and the electricity, not just that. He had a lot, and of course, he was flamboyant, I think. Then you had Roger Sherman and Robert Livingston. All five of those men were responsible for taking the rough draft that he did, and they sat down and they worked on that to get it finalized. The final document was presented to Congress on June 28, 1776. So that's really in a span of like 3 weeks that they had this document ready for the Second Continental Congress. And I made some notes here about this. Four times in the Declaration of Independence, four times God is mentioned. First of all, God's law is mentioned. He is mentioned as the creator. He is mentioned as the supreme judge. And he's mentioned as divine providence. When we get into the next section about faith and what I dug up, it's clear that they understood to some degree that there was a creator that was guiding this. In fact, George Washington believed in providence when his clothes were all shot up and his hat was shot up and he was never killed. He believed that was God's divine protection on his life. So anyway, quite an amazing document. The Declaration of Independence was adopted on July 2nd, 1776, but wasn't finalized until July 4th, 1776. So it was adopted. This Declaration of Independence that those five men had worked on were put before, and it was adopted, and then it was finalized again, finalized on July 4th, 1776. John Hancock and Josiah Bartlett were the two that first signed the Declaration of Independence. That's why today we say, "Give me your John Hancock." His is in big letters. The Declaration of Independence was finally signed on August 2nd, 1776, though some of the 56 delegates signed later than that. So the reason that we celebrate July 4th is because of the fact that it was finalized on July 4th, but not actually. I know we get this idea that, oh, everybody signed it on July 4th. That's not really the case. It was signed about a month later, August 2nd. Yeah, about a month later. And though, so again, and it really depended on the location of where you were. Some of the colonists in South Carolina took longer to get there to sign it. This is largely wrong. During this period, you have these delegates traveling to, and it, probably in August, this might have been more accurate, but between the 4th of July and August 2nd, you had all of these delegates coming back and forth signing this Declaration of Independence. I mean, it looks nice. It could be partly true, but mostly not. This is, you all know what this is? This is Independence Hall in Philadelphia. This is where the 56 delegates would have met. One of these days, we're getting ready in September, the second week in September, Audrey and I are traveling up to Mount Rushmore. And I think the next trip will be to Independence Hall, because I do want to see where they signed, where all the delegates met and discussed this heated debate. New York was a holdout for a while. South Carolina was a holdout for a while. But anyway, that's the actual place. This is where 56 delegates put their life on the line so that we can sit here today and worship God as we want. How many of us would have done that? That took courage and it took guts to do that. So this is, when you just look at this picture, it's just awesome. So let's now transition into talking a little bit about three tenets of the Declaration of Independence. By the way, I have no notes. I've just memorized this stuff, so going that way with it. First of all, natural rights. All people are created equal and possess unalienable rights, including life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Quite well done by Thomas Jefferson, who owned many slaves. In fact, Sally Hemings, a black slave, gave birth to six of his children. And this was after Thomas Jefferson's wife died. He loved her. Of course, they go to France. He takes Sally Hemings with him. And when Thomas Jefferson's in office, there's this scandal that's brought up, but it's quickly poo-pooed. Nothing really comes from it. But it's interesting. We're not a perfect nation. But I'll say this. Thank God that we live in America. We have the freedom to be anything that we want to be. And we go on the backs of the original framers of this Declaration of Independence. So natural rights, all people are created equal, have access. But like I said, it would be another 100 years before the slavery issue would actually be solved. George Washington had slaves. Thomas Jefferson was one of the big ones, and there were many other founders that had slaves. Of the 56 delegates, half of them, in my study and research, half of them had some form of slaves. And yet, they wrote this document that said, all men are created equal. So, it wasn't perfect. And like I said, it would take another 100 years for slavery issue to be dealt with. Social contract. Governments are created, this is extrapolated from the Declaration of Independence. Governments are created to protect the natural rights, that's the rights we have as Americans, and derive their just power from the consent of the governed. So what this says is that we put the delegates in place by way of voting. They then, as our representatives in the House and the Congress, they are the ones that are supposed to protect the rights that we have. I don't think I've ever seen a period of time when there has been so much political confusion in our country. But I will say this, at least we're not going out on the street and doing duels. This actually happened back in the day. Number three. And I think the most important and often overlooked part of the Declaration of Independence. The right to revolution. Remember, the founders had just gone through this long series, which took, well, I think probably 10, 11 years, and the Congress talking about it. If any government becomes destructive and fails to protect these rights, we the people have the authority to alter or abolish it and to form a new one. If there ever comes a day when the government decides they're going to take us over and squash those rights, the framers gave us the ability to say, uh-uh, we're going to throw you out. Many Americans don't know that. We could actually have a new constitution drafted if that becomes the case. And thankfully, to this point, it has not become the case. So that's the Declaration of Independence in a nutshell. Now I want to get to the faith of our fathers. Volumes. Volumes have exhausted this particular portion of the Founding Fathers. But I narrowed it down into what I think are three categories. The first category is Orthodox Christianity. That'd be a Baptist, Presbyterian, Anglican, and a lot of Founding Fathers were Anglican, Methodist, along those lines. Those are Orthodox Christianity. There's a second one, which is, I don't agree with how they worded it, but Christian deism. I don't think you can put Christian in front of it. It's theistic rationalism, a belief in the Creator who set the world in motion but rejects the Trinity. I'm going to give you a few little notes here. John Adams was probably influenced by the Enlightenment period, and he eventually became a Unitarian. Of course, Thomas Jefferson, I don't know what he put God and divine creator. I'm sure that Thomas Jefferson believed in a form of God, but that God was not really involved in the daily lives of people. Benjamin Franklin started out with this Enlightenment theistic rationalism, but I do believe towards the end of his life, Benjamin Franklin might have become a Christian by some of the things that were said. Thomas Paine was the loudest voice for this. Thomas Paine he wasn't anything really, but crazy stuff. A third category of Founding Fathers' faith was non-Christian deism, rejected Christianity, dismissed the Bible and its teachings, and this was a smaller group, not of the larger group, but a smaller subsection of the delegates that believed that the Bible was nonsense. It is amazing that the Declaration of Independence gave them the right to believe that way. You go out here in our city this morning, you'll have people that don't care anything about the Bible, and that's their right as Americans. But it is also our right as Americans and Christians to share with them the good news of Jesus Christ. All right. Let's talk about George Washington. George Washington, he was baptized and raised in the Anglican Church. You know, sometimes you look at Washington and you think, I don't know. And sometimes you look at him, he's dead on it. But anyway, he was raised in the Anglican Church. He believed God was guiding America during the Revolution, and actually believed in the providence of God in his own life because of what happened on the battlefield. He was very private. In fact, when counts say that when he raised his hand to become the first president, you could barely hear him. Thomas Jefferson was actually the same way when he gave a speech to Congress. You could barely hear him. People are like, what? So he didn't talk loud. He was extremely private. He did not share his faith. Very private about what he believed. But he did attend religiously morning prayers and evening prayers, and on one occasion was even said to have had his Bible open when he was praying and reading scripture. So I'm gonna say that I do believe that George Washington was a Christian, but maybe not the way we define our beliefs today. During the Revolution, he attended various services, Presbyterian, wherever he was. Of course, he had a war going on, so he but he did it morning and evening And so he was very active participating in worship services. Let's see what else I'm going to say here about old George. All right, let me give you some of George Washington's favorite verses. And when we talk about verses, keep in context that this was in context of the American Revolution. All right, George Washington, one of the verses that he used a lot was this one. And it comes from Micah 6:8. He has shown you, old man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. I would say this about George Washington. I think that was the epitome of his life. He was a very humble person. He wanted to act justly. When he defeated the Hessians at Trenton, he was very gracious to the commander of the Hessian army. And I think he had a reputation of being fair, just, and he did not have pride. And I think that's why Washington is George Washington's elevated today, and why he really is the father of our nation. George Washington said this September 19, 1796, of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. And I think George Washington viewed religion as a way of helping society develop its morality. Another thing George Washington said, and this is all the way through his, sometimes it looks like he jumps here and then he jumps here, but he also said this: it is impossible to rightly govern a nation without God in the Bible. So when we won our independence from Great Britain and the first election where George Washington finished first and John Adams finished second, and back in those days, when you finished second, you became the vice president. So it was George Washington and John Adams were the first installed. George Washington did not want to be called a king because they just got rid of a king. So they came up with the name, the President of the United States. So George Washington, from my understanding, I believe George Washington was a believer, not in the classical sense that we would, you know, we have these different statements of faith, but again, we're a very young nation. Now, one guy I can tell you for sure, and that was Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry was a member of the Anglican Church. His mother frequently took him to see Samuel Davies, who was a evangelical Presbyterian minister. There's a picture of him there who's got his wig on. Maybe I should start wearing wigs to church. I don't know. For thou knowest. He died in 1761. Davies did, but I think Patrick Henry was really influenced by his sermons. I do. Patrick Henry really had a zeal for Orthodox Christianity. And I think Samuel Davies propelled that even more. Patrick Henry believed that Christian churches were the safeguard for public morality and virtue. You know, the Bible tells us that 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 says that the only thing, I'm going to paraphrase it, the only thing that keeps morality and the world in check right now is the church and the Holy Spirit. When that's taken up out of the way, everything breaks loose. I do think our church here today should influence culture. The culture should not influence the church. And I think that was Patrick Henry's understanding, that Orthodox Christianity should be the guardrails for society, even though people have the right to say, no, we don't want that, or we don't even like that. Samuel Davies, he was actually the fourth president of Princeton University from 59 to 61, and of course, shortly after that, he died, but it left a big influence on Patrick Henry. Some of Patrick Henry's favorite verses. One of them is, make the effort to live in peace with all men, to be holy. Without holiness, no one will see God. Hebrews 12:14. Again, this was used in light of the separation from Great Britain. Let's try to just live at peace. And I think for the most part, that's a call for us too, to live at peace and be holy. And of course, by virtue of our relationship with Jesus Christ, we are holy. And it's a positional righteousness. Another verse that Patrick Henry liked came from the book of Proverbs. Godliness makes a nation great. There you go. That's that guardrail mentality of Patrick Henry. Godliness makes a nation great, but sin is a disgrace to any people. So he really believed that the church should influence and shape the culture. And I fully agree with that. Too often in today's society, the culture is influencing the church. Look at how many denominations have just completely abandoned traditional Christian faith. We have all kinds of stuff floating around now. It's because the church has lost the vision that we are the changers of culture. And we do that by representing Christ in the world. That's what we do. We go out into the culture and we tell people about Jesus Christ. This was an interesting, and this next quote, has really caused scholars to maybe rethink, I think, the Christian faith of the fathers. We know Jefferson, we know Adams. They were, by all accounts, not Christians. I hope they got saved towards the end of their life. But Patrick Henry said this: it cannot be emphasized too strongly or too often that this great nation was founded not by religionists, but by Christians. Not on religions, but on the gospel of Jesus Christ. If anybody would have known the original founding fathers, it would have been Patrick Henry. So when we think about the Christian faith of the early fathers, I think we need to give a little wiggle room where things are clear, we can see it clearly. But what happens here is, do you know that 250 years has passed and it's still going on? The church has not been destroyed, no matter how hard they've tried to. We are now the bearers of freedom, not only freedom in the nation, but in Christian freedom. And anyway, that's what I wanted to share with you this morning, those verses, and talk a little bit about the Declaration of Independence and the underpinnings of how we got to where we are today. I have a little video here, and we'll close out.